Every 2 years.
The committee would come to order, please. This is the House Finance Committee. It is Wednesday, February 18th. It's approximately 1:45 in the afternoon. We have two resolutions to consider today. The first one I'd like to take up is House Concurrent Resolution 24. The committee staff will be distributing a proposed CS in just a few minutes. I did want to take up the public testimony portion, though, right away. We have to testify to us today Senator Wilken, who has been working with the Deferred Maintenance Task Force along with Representative Mulder through the summer, and also has done quite a bit of work with the Fairbanks Borough School District, who I think may be the district that utilizes the prototypical concept the most. So Senator Wilken, if you'd like to go ahead with your comment.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you, members of House Finance, for the opportunity to talk a little bit about prototypical or Alaska standard schools. A little history, if I might, through my association with Fairbanks School District. I remember back about 10 years ago as they agonized over the decision whether to start a prototypical program. And so at that time, it was brought to my attention that such an effort was going to begin. And I can say 10 years hence that our school district is indeed pleased with the effort. And frankly, if I could speak for them, would have it no other way for their elementary schools. We put together, when the Deferred Maintenance Task Force was in Fairbanks, the school board put together a board, which we have here, that shows the different seven different prototypical schools in Fairbanks. And I commend that to your review, just to see a little bit about how they look. In many ways the same, in many ways much different. This fall I had the opportunity with Representative Mulder and some of the others to visit some villages. Visited Norvik, Kiana, Shinyek, Golovin, and one I'm missing right now. But Buckland. How could I forget our visit to Buckland? We had a great time. And it occurred to me that as I sat there, obviously they had a plea for schools. And when I saw that, they need schools. They need schools in each of those five villages that we had the opportunity to visit in. And as I thought about the city, the village of Buckland and Kiana, and I thought about the success we've had with schools in our city, I said, why couldn't we bring a miniature Ann Wien school to Buckland? Why couldn't we put three schools on a barge and drop one off in Cayenne and one off in Buckland and one off in Kobuk? Why do we need to do it one at a time? Why do we need to start from scratch? And so with the support of the Deferred Maintenance Task Force, we began the effort to investigate the thought of prototypical schools. This is an effort to get a set of conceptually three plans north of the range, south of the range, and southeast Alaska that we could use for essentially K-6 or K-8, but whatever they happen to define as schools. It's an effort to validate the needs of school districts. We have sitting at the cork, what I refer to the cork in the top of the bottle as the Kashunamut School for $28 million for 230-some or 260-some children. Never been to Kashunamut. Someday I may. But I have to ask the question, why do we build a $28 million school for 260 students in Kashunamut? And we just finished an elementary school in Fairbanks for $9.9 million for 600 students. I know it's different. I know it's different requirements, different parts of the city, or different parts of the state. But I think each of us have to say, why the difference? And so this is an attempt to get some basis of information for us that we can use as decision makers as to the value of school requests. This is an effort to get more schools out earlier. We need to go down that list, and if we can get one school free with 10, then we certainly ought to do that. And I think that's perfectly possible to do. This is an effort to not only to build schools that are somewhat standard and still represent the community, but it also enables those communities that have now been funded, the majority, if not all the schools, have been funded by the state, They now have a standard school that they can use for standard maintenance. And so not only do we get it cheaper, they have a product that they can maintain in a more standard manner. So they save over the life of the 40 or 50 years of the school. And it's an effort to identify if indeed we can't use a particular prototype or a standard school in a particular part of the state, we can certainly use certain components that we become accepted as part of our schools and are mandated to be used for whatever reasons, for reliability, value, maintenance, whatever we decide. So that's what the effort is about. There's a man in our city, my name is Lynn Mackler. Lynn has done a wonderful job of maintaining our schools and planning for them. And he's not able to be with us today, but with your indulgence, I'm going to list down a few of his bullets that he would say, and I won't do it as well as Lynn will, but I'll try to paraphrase what he would tell you and what he has told other committees that he's testified. I asked Lynn one time, "What give us the pluses and the minuses?" And the first minus was there are some folks in the state that don't particularly want this to happen because they think it's a threat on their industry. And I perfectly appreciate that concern, and this is not an effort to run anybody out of business. And from then on, that's about all the minuses there are. Lynn will tell you that he gets, from the time the people pull the ballot lever to the time they open the doors to get the kids into school, it's a year less than it used to be. He gets more school quicker to the voters, and he gets it at 1 year less inflation. He'll tell you that he used to spend 10 to 12% on architectural and engineering designs for every school. He now spends 5. He'll tell you that on a competitive bid, that the bids get better and better and better because it's essentially a standard school, and each of the contractors know that the contractor before them made money on it, and they know it's not some job that they're going to have to design from scratch. So they sharpen their pencils a bit to the benefit of the customer. There are very few change orders in the prototypical schools, markedly less than there have been when you start a new school from scratch. The education program, the customers, the students, and the teachers, they had a bit of a problem entering into a prototypical program. But each time you build a school, they are fully involved in the debrief on what's good and bad, and that's rolled into the next school. So today you'll talk with teachers and students in Fairbanks, and you'll find that school 7 is much better than school 1, and they're getting better each time. So the program, educational program, is accepted and improving. The technical upgrades are able to be incorporated to the maximum because we're not reinventing. The school is standard, so you can take full advantage of technical upgrades without having to redesign the school. Startup, he would say that startup problems the first year are minimal in each school they move into. They've already been through the different heating controls. They've been through the doors that swing the wrong way. They've been through all those sorts of things that start the first year to just be bugs you got to work out. And he'll talk about the standardization of machine components that have allowed the Fairbanks School District to go from 18% of their budget on maintenance down to, I think it's 10, but it's a market improvement. So that's my thoughts on it. With the Deferred Maintenance Task Force, we saw an obvious need for schools. And this is an opportunity to try to quantify it, try to standardize it. And indeed, if 8 out of 10 the places we need to build schools, we can build a standard Alaska school with the input of the local community that reflects as much as we can their input through our 1% for arts or through their involvement, then we should do that. Our goal ought to be, as the decision makers, and our goal ought to be as the legislature, to produce a prototype school that's not imposed from the top down on these places, but one indeed that works so well for this town and that village that they, when it comes time for them to have a school, they want the Alaska Standard School or the prototype school. We have the opportunity, we certainly have the need, so I encourage the support of this resolution, and we'll begin with DOE and the Bond Reimbursement Committee the effort to get more out of our dollar. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk a bit, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Senator, I forgot to look up on the paperwork there on your chart. What span of time are we talking from the very first?
This school was just opened, Crawford Elementary, which just opened in August. Ann Wien was opened a year ago. It's 9.9 million. All these are 600 student schools.
The last one was 1997.
1987 or 86. Oh, 83. And this is where it kicked in. They took that plan. This is where it really kicked in 87. This was the decision time I remember becoming aware of the issue.
And just from traveling around to the rural sites that you did, I mean, in Fairbanks, we have all those school buildings are built on flat land. We have quite a bit of that available. But traveling around out in rural Alaska, it would seem to me that with a lot of communities on river, banks of rivers on bluffs, will they have enough, will there be enough commonality out there in even the same temperature region, that you think a real standard design would fit?
Or I would certainly think so. This school here at U Park is built on pilings. You don't know that, but it's on permafrost and built. The whole school is built on pilings. Mm-hmm. I would, as I said, there's probably a north of the range, south of the range, and a southeast school. But this is a variable. The school package is a school, and I suspect that there'll probably be some variations in roof because of winds and snow load and that type of thing. But this is a 600. These schools that we're familiar with, they're 600 student schools. If we look at Buckland, they have a school of 60. So they would take an office and they take a gym or two and they would take four gymnasiums, put it on a barge and take these components and build it in Buckland. Surely in Buckland and in many villages, many places around the state, you can find enough flat space to put a school that's one half of that size or a quarter.
Okay, Representative Martin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's got to be something wrong with this. Too logical and too efficient. Well, what's the negative downside that you heard, sir?
I think that we just need to burst through the fact that it can't be done. And I think that we need to step back and see, and if it's the craziest idea that ever came down the pike, so be it. But at least we have one, and Anchorage has a couple of schools that they're starting prototypes on for.
Right.
I know Kenai does. It's I don't think there's much downside.
I didn't think so either.
We may roll the dice here with a few bucks and come up dry, but I don't think we will.
You haven't much static against the architectures or the artist people that think we need to be aesthetic and we need to be creative. It's very expensive the way I looked at it.
Well, if I were that profession, I would see it as a threat to my livelihood. But at the same time, if we're building 11 schools where we used to build 10, we still have people involved. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're going to wipe out the A&E industry in Alaska. I think this is just a simple effort to make it better. And that there is some concern about local involvement and how the school should reflect the town. And while I certainly accept that and local people ought to be involved in their school, I'm not sure it's incumbent on the state to produce a monument to a particular town, city, or village through its education system. We have 1% for arts that I'm 100% supportive of, and that's one effort that's guaranteed to reflect their particular state of mind at the time the facility was built.
Are there further questions? Representative Foster.
You want to move it?
Actually, we have one other person from the Department of Education signed up to testify, Michael Morgan.
Thank you for your time, and I'm going to excuse myself. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Senator Wilken.
Senator Wilken? Actually, if he's leaving, I actually wanted to ask one quick question.
Uh-oh.
Too quick. Just, I know that there's likely to be a proposal to delete the word elementary in there, and I just wondered if you had any problem doing that.
Yes, thanks. No, not a problem at all. We were just trying to draw some boundaries, and we missed the target because some villages, Buckland, for instance, it's an elementary design, but it's K-8 or K-12, so It's not really a high school.
And I think also there's perhaps a proposal coming to do a statutory site on the grant review or the bond review committee, and that's just, in my understanding, a technical change. Do you have any problem with that?
No, I think it clarifies it. It's an attempt to clarify the resolution, and one of the charges of the bond reimbursement committee that I've been to two or three meetings, and it's led by Mr. Morgan, one of the six charges that this legislature put in place in 1993, I believe, was to analyze, evaluate, and bring forth recommendations in the prototypical school issues. So we're really fulfilling the wishes of the past legislature by doing this, and we see the vehicle and the need through the Deferred Maintenance Task Force.
Representative Davies, those two changes are incorporated in the draft CS that was just distributed.
I understand that. I just want to make sure we have a comment from the sponsor on that.
Mike, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Michael Morgan. I'm the facilities manager for the Department of Education. And the department's offered for this committee's consideration two papers, one attached to the fiscal note of two pages, and then a briefing paper that was prepared a year ago or last year for the Bond Reimbursement Grant Review Committee on the issue of prototypes. Just to briefly highlight, there are benefits of prototypes when there's a situation where they're effective, and those benefits essentially, as Senator Wilkin enumerated, are savings and design costs, savings when you have a limited contractor pool on the construction costs, and then downstream savings on maintenance operations and repair costs. Some of the limitations certainly are adapting to varying climates and sites. And I think that even looking at these pictures, you can see that can be an issue, because one of the common features of all these schools is that they have flat roofs. And we certainly know with all the roof problems there have been in Southeast, those roofs don't work well. And then in high snow load climates, there are also problems with those roofs. I believe Fairbanks, when they had an extreme snowfall several years ago, was up with snow blowers and all their roofs blowing the snow off them. Also, we have a varying size requirement running, as Senator Wilkin mentioned, from a school that has a need for 50 students up to what they're building here at 600 students. So that range of sizes is also a challenge in applying a prototypical design. One of the other challenges in applying prototypes is the issue of having varying educational programs. And with that still at a local control issue, that's an issue that needs to be considered. And then these tend to apply primarily toward new schools, though if we get into the issue of prototypical components, then there's more application in the additions which are being done across the state. And a lot of the schools that we have proposed before us are additions. The department certainly supports this as a cost containment measure, and would like to point out that there are a number of other cost containment measures which we'd hope would also be considered at the same time, because certainly we see a lot of schools brought before us where the costs are very high, and we need to maximize the value of each dollar so that we can have them go as far as possible in solving the educational needs.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Davies.
With regard to the issue of the appropriateness of a design for a particular area, as I read the resolution, there's nothing that specifies the number of prototypical designs in here, so that it would, I presume, reading this, that the state will be developing a set of prototypical designs to meet varying climatic conditions. Is that your understanding of the resolution?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, that's correct. As I understood in conversations with Senator Wilkin, what we'd look at are not only some for regional variations to account for climatic differences, but we'd also look at some kind of in a matrix for maybe four different size ranges. So we look at a variety of prototypes. And I think one of the things that the committee is also going to discuss is the use of prototypical components. In other words, can we design two or three size gymnasiums and configurations and have those designs set out there so they could be attached to schools and we wouldn't have to go through that issue on a repeated basis.
Representative Davies?
Thank you. I'm a little concerned that the that there may be an effort to go out and design the full gamut of the possibilities. When this process went through in Fairbanks, we looked at a particular, we had a particular design that we started with and then focused in the building of one particular school and used the money that was going to be required for the design of that school, augmented it a little bit to come up with a prototypical design. Is there any reason why the department couldn't work with the various regions of the state to do effectively the same thing? In other words, to not go out and, separate from the actual building of a school, develop a prototypical design, but to develop that in using the money that's going to be, would have been used to design a particular school anyway, and then add, augment that to come up with the prototypical design.
The chair, I think that we're trying not to go into this with preconceived notions about the approach to take, and I think that certainly sounds like a very reasonable one, because then we have an application which, if in the design process we could give it maximum flexibility, could be replicated. And that's a very nice
answer. My question was, is there any reason why you couldn't do that terms of this resolution?
There's no reason why we couldn't do that.
Thank you.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In partial response to Representative Davies' question to Mike, we did, when we went to Buckland's fairly high on the list, and in fact there are several schools, as the Senator reflected, from the Northwest Arctic Borough and School District, which are all very high on the list, and they reflected a willingness and an interest to do exactly that, to be the first test case. And so, while it's not explicitly stated, there have been communities that stepped forward and said, yeah, we'll participate and try and make this work, not only for us, but set up the example for the future. They see a real benefit from it, because as we are now, another part which we're not considering, but nonetheless I'll talk about, one of the requirements that we're going to begin passing along to school districts is that if we're going to give you money, we expect that you have a maintenance program in place. They view it as a cost savings measure in the sense that it's easier if you can train people on one design, they know that design, they can move from Kiana, Norvik, Buckland, and they can work on basically the same building. And they won't have to have as such a diverse background. And they look at it as real cost saving. Mike, do you anticipate that you'll include your cost containment suggestions in the requested March 15th report?
Through the chair, we would include a variety of cost containment ideas in that report so that the legislature has, so to speak, a cookbook to pick from and maybe mix and match a variety of options as you look at this issue. Certainly in some of the preliminary research we've done, we looked at, for example, at British Columbia, and one of the things they've done to contain costs is they've just said you can spend X number of dollars per square foot. You can have an adder for being in the very north of British Columbia or in different areas, and that's one way they're containing costs. They're also requiring value analysis on their projects. So we'll put in a variety of those things and explain them and the benefits that accrue with them.
Thank you. Thank you. We have one person on the teleconference. We have Doug Green with the Alaska Professional Design Council. Mr. Green, are you there? If you would go ahead with your comments, please.
Okay, thank you. This is Doug Green. I'm an architect in Anchorage with the Alaska Professional Design Council. And we have testified a couple of times on this issue and would like to do so today, stating that in our research nationally, we've come up with a number of states that have attempted a prototypical design program for their school systems and have found that they have accomplished it in a couple of locations, but for the most part, most of the states have determined that this type of a program was not successful. So we wanted just to make with the concept of trying to develop an entire school, or as was brought out, maybe 8 to 10 or 4 to 5 entire school designs that tend to be have the difficulty of having to be site-adapted foundation systems, et cetera, et cetera. There's a multitude of variations that might have to be made on these buildings, and we're looking at maybe spending the efforts to standardize the pieces instead of trying to standardize the building, which is going to be difficult to accomplish. We also would like to point out that the major insurance companies, which cover our errors and omission insurance, are concerned about this type of an approach, and most of the designers within the state are covered by one or two main carriers. Those carriers have gone on record as stating that they are not supportive of this of prototypical design, where one A&E may create the design and then others end up modifying that design, and the liability for those designs becomes clouded. And they're concerned about that and what that might do in the future. So we want to be cautious. We think that the Department of Education is correct and that there are a lot of different variety of ways to reduce the cost of these schools, and we need to explore those, such as peer review, looking at the possibility of value engineering, setting upward limits and budgets. There's a variety of different things, even in the education specifications themselves that drive the design of these various schools throughout the state. Those could be standardized further than they are at this point. Also, we've pointed out that studying what has been done and what works out there, the kind of lessons learned database creation, is also an excellent way to find the solutions out there and to utilize those solutions that have proved valuable and have actually saved and reduced costs.
Thank you.
So basically, our sense is we are committed to being involved in this process. We certainly understand the issue quite well, and at this point are encouraging the committee to look at the possibility of maybe taking even the term prototypical out of the resolution, although I understand that many people will have a direct connection to that term. They envision the same type of schools getting plunked down all over the state. But I think that's the exact reason why we think that potentially a standardized design component term might be a better replacement for the prototype design term. Basically, that sums up what we would like to say today.
Thank you, Mr. Green. With regards to the component language in the proposed CS and actually the version of the resolution that came to the committee, we've made some proposed modification to that, but it speaks to the identifying components within a prototype building design that can be standardized and can be incorporated into school designs in those instances where a prototype design may not be appropriate. So looking at components of schools, say a multi-purpose room that in a village would be sort of a community gymnasium, the cafeteria, that type of thing that would fit a community of 50 to 100 students maybe. And then from when you go from village to village, you add on additional classrooms, but you don't necessarily have to redesign the entire multi-purpose room. So I think we've got language in here that talks about the component mechanism that you would like to see.
Right, and I saw that in the original bill. Our concern was that if that language that is in there about the components was just substituted throughout for the prototype design, then you basically change the sort of the initial thrust of the bill, but you still could do prototypical full school design utilizing all of the design components. So it was just another way of looking at it that maybe didn't start us off too much right on the wrong foot of trying to develop a whole school approach, you know, trying to get a whole school design done for every site.
Representative Davies.
Thank you. Mr. Green, you referenced some research into other states and indicated that you'd come across a number of instances of failure in those attempts, but you didn't indicate what the reasons for that failure, what those reasons were. Do you have you analyzed that data enough to be able to summarize some of the principal reasons for failure? And would you be willing to provide that research to us?
We are attempting to get the actual 1991 Georgia Department of Education study or survey that was done of 49 states looking at the feasibility of stock land use both typical design and on space. To date, the Department of Ed has asked me for this also. I have not been able to get the actual original data on the survey. We have North Carolina's legislative package that they put together from that data, which I can certainly fax you down. It's three pages of just some of the states' experience, California, Colorado, Indiana, experiences with these types of projects. And as soon as I can get a line on the actual original version of that, I will forward that to the committee if they would like to.
Specifically, do you know if those in those instances, if those were generally top-down, state-mandated, one-size-fits-all requirements?
Well, for instance, California reported that they had a law that was put in place in the 50s requiring the design of all state-owned buildings be performed by their Office of Architecture and Construction. And so that was definitely a top-down sort of a mandate. It looks like the Indiana did the same sort of a thing with the legislation. The legislature developed a proposal that mandated elementary schools be built on a stock plan. Most of these look like they dated from the time period around the late 50s to the 60s. So, and were all repealed in the 70s. So these are fairly old experiences, it looks like to me, with the idea of prototypical design. As I recall, our state also had a little round with it in the 70s.
Representative Davies.
If I could, Mr. I just had two more questions, sort of a comment on that one. I wanted to ask you if you were aware that in this resolution, it's up to the local school district to decide whether they want to do this.
Yes, and I think that's an excellent direction. It certainly should be locally have local participation and
pay the bill.
Some of the smaller
Okay, I wanted to change topics here a little bit and talk about the insurance. I'm not aware that there have been any problems with insurance liability issues in the Fairbanks instance. My question was, I actually have two pieces to this question. One is, are you aware of any specific insurance problems that have evolved from the Fairbanks or the limited experience in Anchorage specifically? And secondly, you indicated some support for the component approach, for example, designing a gymnasium, and I wondered how that would be any substantially different than the prototypical design, in the sense that my understanding is that there is a primary architect who reviews the whole design package, and it's my understanding that they take the responsibility then for the implementation of that design at that site.
Address the first part of it. As far as Fairbanks and Anchorage go, I don't believe that there is any major liability problem or issue that's come up from that arrangement, and that is mainly because the best of my knowledge, the schools that have been utilized as prototypes have been done by the same firm. In other words, the firm that designed the first school utilized that same school design to replicate it on different sites for the school district. So that same firm has basically produced all of those prototypical schools. And that's workable within an area, especially in Anchorage, where I think a couple of firms have produced buildings that have been replicated. So in that case, even for a specific site, two or three firms would propose their quote-unquote prototypical school to be built there. And then at least it would be competitive in accomplishing the best wants to be selected for that project. As far as problem that we have, I believe it's when a whole set of drawings is stamped and you have a stamp of an architect on a set of plans. Typically, architects won't or there's no need to stamp a design of a room if it is not connected with a building project. In other words, multiple room designs that could be utilized by another designer incorporated into their overall school plan would not have to be stamped by the original designer. Those could be put forth by the Department of Education as guidelines for standardizing various of a design, so the original architect, whoever puts all of those standardized components together, can still stamp that set of plans and not be using the responsibility to the original designer. No.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if we do put a provision here that allows local school districts to become independent in their own drawings and architecture, that they be some provision that they pay the bill, because we've seen in certain areas where literally beautiful Taj Mahals have been built, and as long as the state pays it and they demand their independence, then they build what they feel like building. But there has to be some responsibility of local governments and boards in paying for what they go beyond what the state feels is reasonable.
Well, Representative Martin, rather than sort of a punishment mechanism for that, what the resolution asks for is some information back from Department of Education about what incentives we can have to lead school districts towards the prototypical type of design. So I think what we're trying to do is lead people to adopt this concept and not punish them for doing something else. Certainly, you know, if...
Well, to them, it's not a punishment, sir.
With a local contribution required, if they want to build something that's extravagant, they have to pick up more of the contribution themselves. That is, in the urban areas, out in the rural district, that's less of a concern. But are there any further questions for any of the witnesses? If not, I would like to move at this time that the language that was passed out be adopted as the working document. And just if the members would make two small corrections, the very first paragraph, the very first whereas there in the second sentence, which requires the state establish, it should say to establish. And the other small correction is the second to the last paragraph needs a period at the end of the sentence.
Where are we now?
The second to the last paragraph just have a period.
On the second page.
And is there objection to adopting this as the working draft before us? And it does adopt the two changes that Representative Davies had mentioned, plus a few mostly just word structure changes. And at this point, I don't know that we have any amendments to the proposed amendments. And there is a zero fiscal note in your packet. And with that, if there are no further questions for witnesses or discussion by the committee, what's the will of the committee? Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I move the bill, I give great credit to the school district of Fairbanks. While I know Anchorage, Mat-Su, and Kenai have also utilized prototypical schools, I think it was Fairbanks' example that really amplified to the committee the full utility and potential of it. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move House Finance Committee substitute for HCR 24, amended with the accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there objection to moving the committee substitute with the individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note? Representative Davies?
Just for some clarification, can you summarize the other changes that are in here?
Sure. Let's see here. On the the fourth whereas, it talked about increasing school needs, putting pressure on local school district budgets, and I just put state and school district budgets. We construct most schools with a combination of state and local funds. So that language was added. The next one was, I think, where it said allowing the school districts to...
Where are we now?
I think on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The sixth one down.
Six whereas?
Yeah. There was some language that said to allow school districts to quicker... And we just put more quickly respond to. It was just a set of structure. The other major thing was we reordered the resolves on the second page. We've got the second and the third resolve. What is now the third resolve was number 4 or 5. So I wanted to talk about a prototypical. Entire prototypical school, then the very next resolve talked about the components, so it just seemed to flow better, so restructured that. And let's see, the other thing was changing the date, the last resolve there, second to the last paragraph, from March 1st to March 15th, just allowing a little bit more time. And then the two changes that you mentioned are incorporated. And the other things were just sentence structure. Just moving a part of the sentence to the beginning instead of the end, but made no substantive change to the the meaning of the paragraph.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there objections to moving the bill from committee with individual recommendations for the resolution? If not, the resolution will move. Okay, next we have House Joint Resolution 53, sponsored by Representative Pete Kelly. Representative Kelly, are you going to testify, or do you have staff that's going to testify?
It's maybe
just you, huh?
In the spirit of correct grammar.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this resolution is a resolution in support of Senate Bill 660, which is federal proposal to contribute 250,000 acres of land for the university. It is an opportunity I don't think we should miss to encourage the Senate to convey that to us. We have a smaller portion of our land given to us for education than any other state. In 1915, I think it was, or 1913, 330,000 acres was given to the state for that purpose. For a number of reasons, that was never conveyed to us completely. We ended up getting about 110,000 acres, 111,000, something like that. And that is what we've been running our state land grant program off of since then. So it's time to give the university a little more money. Through lands management, they've done a pretty good job of managing their lands, as far as I can see. And this is merely a resolution encouraging the Senate to go ahead and pass that bill that Senator Murkowski has before them.
On motion, sir.
Well, Representative Kelly, just a quick question. You talked about the 250,000 acres of land that we would match on an acre per acre basis with the federal government for federal acreage, but then there's another possibility of another 250 for trading out in holdings?
In holdings, yes, in the national parks that's currently held by the university.
Okay. I just wanted to mention that there's two pots of land there, for potential groups of federal land. Are there questions for Representative Kelly? Representative Martin?
Mr. Chairman, I think to show how open-minded that we are for the university, I'd like to ask to pass the committee joint resolution 53 on a committee and with individual recommendation with zero fiscal notes.
There is a zero fiscal note signed by Co-Chairman Hanley and myself. The university indicated to us that the fiscal note would be zero. They didn't have an opportunity to prepare it, but they are in support of this zero fiscal note. So there is a motion to move the resolution with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes. Is there any objection? If not, the resolution will move.
I wonder what I did that time.
I'm sorry.
You went after somebody else's land.
I'm sorry. Before we move the resolution, there was one person that was signed up to testify. My mistake. If Mark Wheeler would come to the table.
I have some copies of our written testimony. Mr. Chairman, members of the House Finance Committee, my name is Mark Wheeler, and I represent the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, I am also a student of the University of Alaska here in Juneau. I respectfully request that my written statement and accompanying materials be entered into the official record for this committee hearing. And I'm also submitting a copy of our statement, which we made before the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee last September. Founded in 1970, SEAC is a coalition of 15 local community volunteer conservation groups in 12 Southeast Alaska communities from Ketchikan to Yakutat. SEAC's 1,200 individual members include commercial fishermen, Native Alaskans, hunters, and guides, tourism and recreation business owners, value-added wood product manufacturers, and Alaskans from all walks of life. SEAC is dedicated to safeguarding the integrity of Southeast Alaska's unsurpassed natural environment while providing for balanced, sustainable use of our region's resources. For the record, SEAC strongly objects to this proposed resolution. We do support adequate funding of the university by the Alaska State Legislature, but we must stand in opposition to this resolution. As the bill currently stands, as amended last September by the Senate Energy Committee, Senate Bill 660 would allow the University of Alaska to select at least 250,000 acres of national forests and other federal land within Alaska that are not conservation system units or legislated LUD-2 areas protected by the Tongass Timber Reform Act of 1990. Up to 250,000 additional acres of national forest and other federal land could be selected if matched by an equal acreage from state lands. Under this bill, 500,000 acres of public lands, including lands within the Tongass and Chugach National Forests, could be selected for clear-cutting and other damaging uses. Currently, the university is forced to squeeze as much revenue as possible from their lands and, in our opinion, has never acted as careful stewards. We think the university will select lands which they can turn into fast cash. They will target Tongass old-growth timberlands and level them as quickly as possible. The university does not manage for multiple use. Instead, they manage their lands much like private lands, laying down massive clear cuts and exporting round logs to Asia while placing the absolute minimum protections on fish and wildlife habitat. Not one Alaskan mill worker is employed using University of Alaska logs, and the University of Alaska doesn't make a priority in hiring Alaskans even to log their own lands. According to some information from the Alaska Department of Labor, the contract logger who was logging the university's land near Cape Yakutaga, near Yakutat, over 70% of those loggers were from out of state. Our main concerns with this legislation that would threaten parts of the Tongass that aren't permanently protected by Congress but are very important to communities, and some of these places include the Cleveland Peninsula, Port Houghton, the Mansfield Peninsula on Admiralty Island, Honker Divide, East Kuyu Island, Uksh Bay, Deep Bay, Poison Cove, and Upper Tanaki Inlet. Over concerns about universities selecting these lands, 10 Southeast Alaskan communities from the city and borough of Yakutat to an ex-KPC logging camp on Prince of Wales Island named Whale Pass, two tribal governments have gone on record opposing this legislation, and I've attached those resolutions to our testimony. Now, there's a lot of, interpretations about this legislation that are sort of wrong. There's this statement that Senator Murkowski and others have made that Alaska has received less land than anybody else, considering the size of Alaska. But when you look at the history in Congress of these land-grant institutions, the Morrill Act of 1862, which created the land-grant system of universities and colleges, was based on state's population, not size. And while it's true that Alaska ranks 48th in the size of federal land grants given to its university, it also ranks 49th in terms of population. The university currently holds 140,000 acres of fee simple land and exactly 173,326 acres of investment property in all. We believe that with this ample land grant and adequate funding from the state of Alaska, our university system should be able to provide quality education for all Alaskans. And in conclusion, we urge you to withdraw this resolution. If you have any questions, I'm free to answer.
Just when you say the university is the way they handled a development of their lands to minimal protections with regards to logging, that would be our own State Forest Practices Act.
Correct.
Which I think really in the nation is kind of considered to be the Cadillac forest practices legislation.
Well, there are minimum buffers on fish streams, but when you look at wildlife habitat, there are basically no protections for wildlife habitat. I've just, flying into Ketchikan and going in there on the ferry, you can see the university's logging operations there, a place people call Slide Ridge locally. And it's basically a, 100% slope that the university logged with helicopters. And, for locals, it seems like only a matter of time before that slides. Just talking to people up near Yakutat, they're pretty upset by the logging in the Yakutaga area. A lot of huge clear cuts and road building and some pretty high quality habitat.
Are there any other questions for Senator Martin?
Just one short note. I think our population, are you using 1990 population?
I think I was using the 1990 census data, yeah.
I think now we're 47th. We're ahead of Wyoming.
Are we?
Rhode Island and Vermont.
So. Okay.
If you upgrade us a little bit,
47.
If anybody would know, it would be Representative Martin. Representative Davies, did you have a question?
No, I'll check it out before I use it.
Okay. I was on the internet using the census data from 1990.
I'd just like to know where in the bill that it requires the university to clear cut the land or to provide damaging uses.
It doesn't require it, but I think just judging from past university management, the university's land trust is required to manage for the benefit of that trust, which requires it to make the most money possible, and I think their interpretation of that has been to clear cut and export the round logs to make the most money, because that is the most profitable way to manage timberlands in South, at least for the short term, in this country here.
So, and you maintain that the university has never acted as a careful steward of the land?
Well, I think we can only judge from our examples here in Southeast Alaska.
And you're referring, and you're aware that in some of those instances, the university has entered into negotiated stakeholder processes with the SEAC and other environmental communities, and that all parties agreed to the process that resulted. And you think in those cases that was not careful stewardship?
I think that was an agreement driven by the political realities of the time. And I don't think there's anything in the bill that requires the university to manage their lands in any way that's more protective than the national forest. You know, we have, with our new Tongass plan, we have considerable improvements over fish and wildlife habitat protections, and those would be sacrificed if the university would be allowed to select that land.
Have you read the Board of Regents policy that was adopted last year with respect to public comment on land management and other things?
I don't think I have seen that exact.
I suggest that you read that. And I'd just like to go on record as saying I completely disagree with the assertion here that the university has never acted as a careful steward. And I don't believe that the university, when they adopt clear cutting, does it in a way that's inconsistent with the Forest Practices Act or with careful stewardship.
Are there further questions or comments?
I disagree with you.
I see Slide Ridge down in Ketchikan.
But I, Mr. Chairman, but my concern is where the logs went, and that fact that there was none of that material was used in the state of Alaska. And in Southeast, there needs to be some improvement.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then we'll conclude the hearing for today. And Mr. Chairman. Representative Kelly?
Have we moved the bill from the committee?
Yes, the bill was moved.
Yes,
it was my mistake to not take Mr. Wheeler's testimony, but I did not have the opportunity to enter that into the record.